Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly Utah news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, while coronavirus cases surge in Utah, Governor Gary Herbert warns that hospitals are starting to fill up. Facing pressure from constituents, lawmakers debate reining in the governor's emergency powers. And candidates for Attorney General and Utah's 2nd District seat clash during debates. Those and other stories coming up on the show. Joining me this morning to talk about all of this, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan, and welcome.
Morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. Also, reporter Bethany Rogers is with us. Welcome, Bethany.
Thanks.
And news columnist Robert Gierke. Good morning to you, Robert. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here as well. Listeners, if you'd like to submit your questions and comments about the stories that we are covering, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW, or you can, yes, you can also call us. The number is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Actually, I think that I'm going to begin today with some audio from a press conference that Bethany Rogers covered, the governor's monthly news conference on PBS Utah. And this is just to sort of set the stage. It's a clip of Dr. Eddie Steniem, an infectious disease medical director for Intermountain Healthcare. This is just to give a sense of where we are in the pandemic and take a quick listen.
I wish today I was coming to you with good news. Really any good news at all. Unfortunately, I'm not. Our cases are at an all-time high. Our hospitalizations are at an all-time high and will continue to rise if this trend in cases continues. The percent of tests that are positive is the highest we've ever seen. 18% was released yesterday, indicating that we are missing many, many infections. For the first time as a physician, I'm scared to see what's to come. I'm scared about the next few months that we will endure here in Utah, unless something changes.
So, Bethany Rogers, that was descriptive of something that health officials are obviously worried about, which is the state of hospitals. And that's because in addition to those percent positives that Dr. Steniem just mentioned, we're seeing record high numbers in hospitals as well. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And even though they've been able to open overflow spaces and, have been able to manage to care for people up to this point, the message was really that the personnel inside hospitals are getting exhausted and that, you know, you can't stretch the health system this thin and just expect them to keep on functioning, that something has to give and that it's really not headed in the right direction right now.
And another concern is that we're also headed into the flu season, which is already taxing on our hospitals generally. One of the things that the governor mentioned during that news conference was that we we're aiming to, prevent death, of course, that's the goal here, but it's also about preventing people just getting the virus because of some of the worrying long-term symptoms, the long-term, maybe even lifelong consequences that that come with this virus. Can you talk about that, Bethany, what the governor said there?
Yeah, I mean, he mentioned that medical experts are beginning to look at and study and understand some of these long-term consequences, but we don't really even know all of them yet. But there are possible consequences for the lining of the heart, blood clots, damage to the nervous system. And then, you know, just on a smaller scale, the governor mentioned he spoke personally about his daughter who had COVID and still hasn't regained her sense of smell 3 months afterwards. He said his granddaughter, too, doesn't have an appetite anymore and has lost a bunch of weight because she just can't really eat the way she did before she contracted COVID. So his message was that it's not without risk even for very young people to contract COVID. You know, I think some people have a view that it's not that big of a deal if you're a very young person. And, you know, he was saying we don't even know what this disease could mean for people in the long run.
Six new deaths were also added to the official tally on Thursday. We've seen 563 deaths total in Utah. We will almost certainly pass the 100,000 case mark today. I want to play another couple of clips from Dr. Steniman at yesterday's news conference. One is sort of a lament from healthcare workers and a request to the public. And then the other is a direct appeal to health officials who were there at his side while he's speaking. Take a quick listen to this one as well.
We've called on the community many times before, and we're doing it again today. We need your help. The message is the same. The science hasn't changed. If you've had any symptoms of COVID-19, regardless of how mild they may seem, get tested, stay home, and self-isolate until you have your test results back. Always wear a mask when you leave the house. Masking is the simplest approach we can take to change the trajectory of this virus. The science is clear. Masks work. When two individuals wear a mask, it is virtually impossible to transmit the virus between them. It's not zero, but the risk is greatly reduced if both individuals are wearing a mask. We also call on our public health officials and our state leaders. Take the appropriate action to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. Don't let COVID threaten the viability of our state healthcare system. Don't let our hospitals get overrun. If that happens, we've failed. Be bold and take decisive action to protect your citizens, even if that's not popular.
And Bethany Rogers, just on that second point, the, be bold leaders, did the governor respond to that appeal or say anything about the fact that that appeal had been issued, that sort of request, I guess? And maybe we could talk a little bit about what that might be underscoring or what the idea behind that message is. But first, what did the governor say in response to that, if he said anything?
Yeah, during the period of the press conference where the governor was responding to questions, he was asked about what else the government could do, especially because, officials and some of the healthcare leaders that we heard from yesterday sounded really frustrated that not everybody is taking this seriously, not everybody is socially distancing, not everybody is wearing masks. So when asked if there could be any type of enforcement or any additional policies that the government could set forward and pass or impose, the governor basically said he feels like they've done everything that they can do. And his quote was that short of locking people up and putting them in isolation, I don't know what else we could do. And he also kind of suggested that in a state like conservative Utah, that being too top down and issuing too many mandates could actually have a counterproductive effect and kind of cause people to rebel. Whereas if you're asking for people's cooperation voluntarily, they might be more likely to comply.
I want to bring in the news columnist on this, Robert Gerke. There's this request from this medical director at the news conference that the governor's at, and then that, Bethany just summed up what the governor's response was. But I guess, what do you think the request was about? Was there something else that the governor could do that's not being done that the doctor is requesting there? Or what's your take on this, Robert Gerke?
Well, I mean, the doctors I talk to keep emphasizing, reemphasizing, reiterating, pleading with people to wear a mask, to have mask mandates in place. And it's got to be, on some level, it's got to be enforceable, too. And so, the data from the state, they conduct these weekly surveys of people where they call them and ask them if they're wearing masks. And, you can take that with a grain of salt, I think, because most people are going to say, yes, they are. But still, only less than 2/3 of Utahns are wearing a mask on a regular basis. And so that's troubling because, as the doctors know, these numbers have not slowed down. They're still increasing at a rapid level and an unsustainable level, as the governor said yesterday. The hospital rooms or the ICUs in particular are strained almost to the breaking point. We've seen in Washington County, they have exceeded capacity in their ICUs and are trying to do surge ICU beds. We've written repeatedly about how the University of Utah exceeded capacity. As the governor said, it's not sustainable. And, he's now moved most of the state into this high-risk area. And that's going to continue for quite some time. And you know, this, the unfortunate thing, and we talked about this weeks ago, yep, is weeks ago was the time for the governor to have done something. I think, you know, you get behind a virus that spreads like this, and it's like trying to get floodwaters back behind a dam. It's already spread so wide that now you're just trying to do damage control, and it's a real unfortunate predicament, and it's really straining our hospitals and medical providers. You know, they talk about the exhaustion they're experiencing. They talk about the heartache they see of families, you know, who aren't allowed to see their loved ones, people dying in isolation. We remain one of the worst states in the country in terms of our COVID rates. We're still, I believe sixth last time I looked.
I think it was nine in the yesterday.
As of yesterday,
that's
nine.
Dan, yeah. Harry there, yeah. Can I ask, you know, I want to just jump in for a second and say, is it that, are people getting complacent or relaxed? I mean, I feel like people were taking this a lot more seriously. You know, the general public was taking this a lot more seriously when the situation with cases and hospitalizations, you know, wasn't anywhere near to as bad as it is now. Are people getting the message, I guess, is the question.
I mean, I think there's an element of fatigue. I mean, it's hard to ask people to change their lives, take these fairly drastic steps for, 7 months, 8 months now that we've been doing this. And I think there's fatigue. I think there are people who aren't taking it seriously. And then you have the people who are outright defiant. You know, they're not going to be told what to do, even if it's to benefit their neighbors, loved ones, friends, family. They're refusing to do it. So it's a combination of things, I think. And then, you know, as the governor has said over and over, as Dr. Dunn has said over and over, we expected an increase with schools reopening. I don't know that anybody predicted the type of increase that we've seen and the severity of it. I think it's a combination of things.
Well, and the question about whether or not the top-down directive would backfire kind of leads into the next conversation that I want to have with Dan Harry, Tribune Government and Politics editor. You know, here we are talking about that potential for some kind of additional action, maybe a mask mandate or whatever it is that the governor could take. Maybe even what a scientist and healthcare professional might be urging him to do, actually, be bold, take decisive action. There's a debate that has been happening among Utah lawmakers over the governor's powers, and some of our elected officials, our legislators, don't want him to even be able to take that bold action or any emergency unilateral action. Can you explain where that debate is happening, Dan, and what it's about?
Well, the legislature met on Capitol Hill this week in interim meetings, and the issue came up during one of these committee hearings, and there's several leading lawmakers. Jake Anderig from Lehigh was kind of leading the discussion on this, saying there still is very much an appetite in the legislature for reining in the governor's powers. And, you know, their approach to this subject is the Emergency Powers Act was never intended for a lengthy emergency as we've fallen into here. That they believe that it was intended for, you know, earthquakes, wildfires, something where dramatic, swift action is required immediately, but then in a relatively short period of time, think laws and powers return to normal. And the fact that this has dragged on as long as it is has really frustrated legislators who feel like they should be the one calling the policy shots. So they talked about this. There's still very much an appetite to do it, but they kind of acknowledge that now probably is not the proper time to do it, that everybody's not on board with a specific plan as yet. So it looks like now that any action on this kind of thing will be deferred until the general session starting in January. Now, we don't know what January is going to look like. We could be much better than we are now in terms of the pandemic, or we could be worse. So we'll just have to see whether anything actually happens on this. It's a philosophic discussion. It's actually been going on in one form or another for years, but if you want to take action on it, I don't know that in the middle of a pandemic is a great time to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm wondering also what's driving that debate. Is it constituents who are, you know, who are contacting lawmakers and saying that they don't, you know, they don't want to do the things that are being asked of them? Or, you know, is the debate that philosophical discussion that's always happening, or is there something else driving it this time around?
Well, I think it starts with that philosophic kind of ideology, the base idea that the legislature has been deprived of powers that rightfully belong to it. And whether that's right or wrong, that's what a lot of legislators believe.
Okay.
And then add on top of it, many of them are in conservative areas, and they're receiving these calls from constituents complaining about things like mask mandates and, you know, business closings. So, yeah, they're getting a lot of pressure from that. So that's added on top of that base of philosophy.
Hmm. We have a caller who called in, asked a question, didn't stay on the line. But the question that is asked, this is Chris from St. George, asks, if the church has weighed in, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has weighed in on the mask wearing, he thinks that would go a long way. Has that happened? Has the church weighed in on whether or not people should be wearing masks? And I'm not certain who to direct that to. Maybe Dan or Bethany Rogers. Does anybody know that the answer to that question?
Roger, I can try to answer that.
Robert,
we've seen them make statements about obeying local laws and directives. They've required members to wear masks in church meetings. There is they have to some degree encouraged it. I don't think they've been very forceful or outspoken in terms of telling members to wear them everywhere, or at least they haven't done as much recently in that regard. So during General Conference, and it was kind of, you know, the timing of it was when one of their leaders, Elder Gong, tested positive. President Nelson, you know, said that the church will exercise caution and follow health guidelines and encourages members to do the same. So, you know, they have encouraged members to do it. I don't know if it's had an effect necessarily. There's still, an undercurrent, I think, in some factions that are resistant to it, but it's sort of an all hands on deck, and the governor has pointed to the church and other churches, religions generally, and community organizations as entities that need to kind of be supportive. It's a unified response.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers Chris's question, but the short answer is yes. They have encouraged people to follow the rules and wear masks.
Okay. Dan, you mentioned that this debate on reigning in the governor's powers right now doesn't appear to be going anywhere, but conceivably in January, the governor could be getting it'll be a different governor, won't it, by that point?
It will be a different governor, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe those powers...
The current one refuses to leave office.
All right, Dan Harry. You know what? We are going to... The pandemic rolls on, and we will, I'm sure, revisit this topic again and again and again. But for the moment, we're going to take our first break in the show. And you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio with reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. When we come back, we will turn to some politics stories, some more politics stories, I guess. Stay with us.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu. Support also comes from Science Unwrapped in USU's College of Science, presenting Smart Cookies by Idaho National Lab cybersecurity specialist Charmaine Sample, Friday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. on Zoom at usu.edu/unwrapped.
My name is Lee Austin, and I worked here for many years as program director and now happily retired and living and listening to UPR mostly in Wayne County at 94.5 FM.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's government and politics editor Dan Harry, reporter Bethany Rogers, and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can call to join the conversation by dialing 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, well, Election Day is now 11 days away. There was a presidential debate last night. Imagine some of our listeners were aware of that fact. This week, there were also some debates here in the state of Utah in the attorney general race and the race for the second congressional district seat. And you know what? I want to talk about what got said in those debates, but I'm actually going to bring in the news columnist first here because, Robert Gerke, I want to ask you for your opinion on what these debates accomplish, be they, you know, the presidential debate or statewide and congressional debates. Are they influencing people in terms of whether or not they're going to vote for one candidate or another? Maybe you could just sort of remind us what these debates are meant to do and the situation that we're in right now.
Well, I mean, I think throughout our political history, debates are kind of pointed to as the idealized version of democracy, right? We get the candidates together. We have, you know, high-minded exchanges of ideas and although, you know, that's the ideal, they regularly don't, you know, meet that expectation. I think we saw yet last night with the presidential debate, the last one, you know, of the series, that these are not exactly, you know, informed decision-making kind of exchanges. But it is still, I think, an important exercise. I think it's important to see the candidates side by side, see them think on their feet, see them be able to defend their positions. And whether they have an effect is a little bit hard to measure, I think. I don't know that it necessarily changes a lot of people from supporting one candidate to another, but to the extent that people watch them, I think if there are undecided voters, it could play a significant role. In these polarized times, I'm not sure that undecided voters are all that common. But and I think particularly for a challenger coming into one of these debates, any of these debates that we've seen, it provides an opportunity for them to be on equal footing with the incumbent. And there's, you know, because incumbency typically has these advantages. You know, in the second district debate, the Chris Stewart, Cale Weston one, I think that one in particular gave, you know, Stewart has tried to pretend that his opponent doesn't exist, I think, to a large extent. And I think it you know, put Stewart on a spot where he has to defend his votes and gives a challenger an opportunity to attack the record.
Okay, so some unscripted interactions and yeah, that chance for accountability being good for the system. You know what, let's begin there in that second congressional district debate. And as you said, the incumbent is Chris Stewart. The challenger is Democrat Cale Weston. Bethany Rogers, you followed this debate. How would you describe the sort of tenor of the debate? How was this debate in terms of its, I don't know, yeah, that, its tenor?
You know, I would say that in the debate, Chris Stewart was placed in a position where he had to defend himself for a large portion of the time. It was tense at times. Cale Weston definitely, you know, took shots at Chris Stewart over campaign finance, you know, accepting money from fossil fuel industries and you know, big money groups, and over missing a vote, over his ties with Trump. So, you know, Cale really kind of went after Chris Stewart, the congressman, on a variety of issues. And, you know, Chris Stewart's been a lot of time defending himself, defending his connections to Trump, defending Trump himself, and defending his own conduct, even his health care plan. There was an interesting exchange about the fact that, Chris Stewart wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. And, they had a pretty sharp exchange of words over the fact that, Chris Stewart says, "I'm on Obamacare, so I know firsthand, how flawed it is." And, Cale Weston saying, "Well, you're not on the same package as everybody else."
And then he himself saying that he also is on Obamacare was an interesting, there's the incumbent Chris Stewart, who has as a name and, as Gerke points out, has that kind of recognition because he's been there for 7 or 8 years now. But then there's the challenger, the Democrat. Who is this guy? Who's Cale Weston, Bethany?
Yeah, so he is a former diplomat, and he's done a lot of writing. He's a Salt Lake City resident, and he has had a really quite fascinating life. He's worked for the government, spent some time over in Afghanistan, dealing with the Taliban at times. He speaks about the time spent in war zones, the time spent negotiating with people. Since returning, he's, as I mentioned, he's done a lot of writing. He's written a book about a memoir of his experiences abroad and his own family. His family has deep roots in Utah. His father was a downwinder, and his family is from rural Utah. Now he lives in Salt Lake City. But he's a pretty interesting guy with a very colorful past.
Well, and they're both, I guess they're both of the candidates. Was it just the Democrat and the Republican on the stage, Bethany?
No, there was also a Libertarian candidate, a Southern Utah attorney who's named J. Robert Latham, who also polled well enough to earn a spot on the stage.
You said that the part of this was a referendum on the president, on Donald Trump and the administration's pandemic response, and Chris Stewart defending the president there. I don't know what to do with this. Is there polling on this race, Bethany? And what does it show?
Yeah, so the polling definitely shows that Stewart has a commanding lead. The Utah Debate Commission poll that was conducted ahead of the debate showed that Chris Stewart had, about half support of half the voters who were surveyed, Cale Weston came pretty far behind. It was about 28%.
Can I ask, maybe this is a question for Dan Harry, government and politics editor, a question about Utah's unique cultural makeup. In this state, is it still that the vast majority of people who are members of the church, of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is it that the vast majority are Republicans to this day?
That is true, yes.
Okay. And has the Trump era done anything to that in terms of political makeup of members of the faith?
I was looking at the registration numbers the other day, and it does look like there have been a pretty good jump in the registration for Democrats. About, if I remember correctly, it was about a 50% jump since the last presidential election. And Republicans have also seen a big increase, not nearly as big percentage-wise, but they started with a base so much larger that, the gap between those has become even larger. So it's, I think there are about 4 times as many Republicans registered in the state now as Democrats. Now, there's also the second biggest block of voters is unaffiliated. And we don't know exactly how those people are going to vote in this election. In the past, those that voted, tended to lean toward the Republicans. So, that's our situation right now.
Just out of curiosity, and this is taking us kind of far away from the second congressional debate, but I remember that there was some polling on the presidential race that showed that Donald Trump had a 10-point advantage over Joe Biden in Utah. Is that, do we know if that's still the case? And is there Is there, I mean, I don't know who to ask this to, probably not Dan Harry, maybe Robert Gricke. Is there any chance that that Biden could take Utah?
I think it's highly unlikely, but I think that 10-point advantage, you know, assuming polling's correct, shows that Trump is a lot less popular in Utah than, you know, any past presidential candidate. I mean, it's you don't want to be under 50% if you're an incumbent. He's right at 50. You'd ask about LDS voters. About 58, 59% of LDS voters supported Trump, which is low. When you consider it was both John McCain, Mitt Romney, and in the two prior elections were up over 70% support from LDS voters. And so I think you can kind of see that they're not as crazy about Trump as voters have been in the past. And I think that hurts him in Utah. I'm interested to watch the 4th District race, frankly, because there's a potential there that Trump could lose the 4th District because that's the least Republican district in the state. And that would be significant. And, I mean, obviously the state's going to stay red, but if the district goes blue, I think it marks a pretty significant shift, at least, you know, if not against Republicans, because as we talked about earlier, you know, Spencer Cox, Chris Stewart, other Republicans are likely to win. But in that district, it shows it's highly competitive and that, you know, that the unpopularity of the incumbent president.
Okay.
Yeah, and you remember 2 years ago, the president blamed Mia Love's loss on her trying to distance herself from the president. And we do not have that situation this year.
With Burgess Owens.
Burgess Owens has wrapped both arms around the president and is clinging tight.
Okay. Well, quickly on that, can we just, is there recent polling on that race?
Very close. I think the Deseret News had the most recent poll that showed about a 1 percentage point spread with Owens on top, which really doesn't mean much because it's well within the margin of error. So this is one that the Cook Political Report has labeled a toss-up. We know it's going to be close. Based on past experience, it's going to be close. And so Ben McAdams is fighting for his life, and Burgess Owens is pulling out all the stops.
Okay. I want to move us on to another debate that took place in Utah this week, and that was the debate in the race for Utah Attorney General. And Dan Harry, we will turn to you for this one. There are, there were two candidates on stage, I think, for this debate, as opposed to three,
yeah.
The Republican incumbent and the Democratic challenger. And with that last debate, the Affordable Care Act, as Bethany pointed out, was kind of a central part. And that was also a part of this debate as well because of a lawsuit that the current attorney general is involved in. Can you tell us about that and also how that topic played into this debate, Dan?
Yeah, it started off with the punches being thrown right off the bat, and the first one was thrown by Sean Reyes, but Greg Skordas punched right back. And that was sort of his main theme, was that we have an attorney general who is not working for Utahns, was his argument, because he's one of those who has joined his party in trying to overturn the Affordable Care Act. And talked about the thousands of Utahns that would lose their health care if that were the case. Skordas kept pointing over and over to the fact that Utahns in 2018 approved an expansion of Medicaid, which was part of the Affordable Care Act, and the legislature had refused to do so for years. And he kept pointing that as saying that Reyes was acting directly contrary to the will of the people. Reyes fought back and, you know, saying that there would be health care available, that he was fighting for lower drug prices and more affordable health care, which has, you know, been pretty much the standard line from President Trump on down.
Dan, didn't just on the topic of the Affordable Care Act, didn't Sean Reyes in this the attorney general in this debate say that if that law was struck down, that people wouldn't lose their coverage? And then isn't that simply just not the case? I mean, wouldn't people lose their coverage if the Affordable Care Act was struck down by the Supreme Court?
That's absolutely right. They would lose that coverage unless Congress acts to do something to replace it. You know, the reason the pre-existing conditions are now are covered mandatory by insurance companies is the fact that it's part of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, and there's part of, well, there's the individual mandate, which was the other contentious part of the Affordable Care Act, which I think ended up getting struck down. But yeah, but so Reyes in response said that SCOTUS was fear-mongering by claiming that, you know, people would lose their coverage, and in fact said that he was lying about people losing coverage. And you know, I'm going to just mention that I spoke with both of these candidates as well for the KCPW show in the Hive. And another sort of major topic of this race is fundraising and the AG's office. And Dan, Harry, that's because there's a kind of, I don't know, sordid history with the Attorney General's office and fundraising. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So we've had two previous attorneys general, both were investigated and, in fact, charged, but one went to trial and was acquitted, John Swallow. The other, the charges were eventually dropped before trial. But the accusations, which were, you know, validated by a Republican House investigation, were that the Attorney General had put a sign on the door that it was for sale to the highest bidder, basically to campaign contributors. And the same accusations are being lodged against Sean Reyes. And sort of Exhibit A is Washica, the energy recycler up in northern Utah, which was, you know, indicted. The executives were indicted. I think five were convicted or pleaded guilty to fraud, because they were getting all these federal credits for recycling oil and diesel fuel that they hadn't actually been doing. And Reyes took $51,000 for that, and his campaign spokesman, because the Attorney General will not talk to reporters about his campaign whatsoever, he defers all questions to his campaign manager. His campaign manager said that that money had been placed in escrow and that it was awaiting the outcome of a federal investigation, and that it would be returned if there were charges or convictions resulting. Well, there have been charges and convictions resulting, and now the campaign has told us, well, we've already spent that money. It really was never in escrow. That was a mistake. So there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, Reyes said to me, he said that basically he had been told, or that his campaign had been told by lawyers, that it would be illegal to, you know, send the money back because it would be different money, a different sort of pool of money. And
well, you know, that's an interesting concept. You know, money is fungible. I think you take $50,000 from someone. It seems like if you spent those literal dollars, that you could replace that with other dollars. I don't understand what the point he's trying to make there.
And again, this is his challenger, of course, is lobbying these I don't know, accusations isn't quite the right term, but the idea that, you know, you're taking money from a company that ends up being a scam. And that one of the parts of what SCOTUS is saying is that the Attorney General, after taking that donation, could have done something in terms of, I don't know, prosecuting the company and chose not to.
I mean, he outright said that Reyes had taken the money and turned his head because of it. You know, that's him making that assertion. We don't know that that's true. It was the federal government that was doing the investigation, and Reyes claimed that he had assisted in that investigation. We don't know if that's true either.
There's also questions. I mean, this is inevitably, these debates end up being a referendum on the actions of the incumbent, just because of the fact that, you know, they've got a record to have to defend. There were questions about a contract with a surveillance company, Dan.
Yeah, Banjo, if you remember that company.
Yeah.
Which the state, in particular, Sean Reyes had introduced to a lot of local governments and state governments here, and it was supposed to be a predictor of crimes and events, for instance, using social media and 911 calls and traffic reports and traffic cameras, gathering, just sucking up all of this information, and was supposed to have an ability to predict events for which, you know, government manpower, police, fire, so forth, could be marshaled and directed at these events, even as they were developing. That was the concept, and very controversial. The legislature itself had, some legislative leaders had described this as a Big Brother network, surveillance. The company itself denied that it was doing any kind of illegal surveillance on the citizens of Utah, and that it destroyed its data, that it wasn't preserving it. But it, the company was not very transparent. Its operations were always kind of opaque. The leader was a sort of a charismatic fellow who, as it turns out, and at what ended the state's contract with the company was, it turned out that when he was 17 years old, he'd been associated with a white supremacist attack on a Jewish synagogue.
And that ended the contract. We're kind of running low on time here. And so maybe, Dan, a couple of things that I will ask just to wrap this up. And I do want to bring Robert Gerke, the news columnist, in on this race as well. But, Dan, do we have polling numbers on this race?
Polling shows that Sean Reyes, the Republican, is well ahead. Greg Skordas, who's very well known in the legal community, is not very well known outside it. And he's a Democrat. He's got the D behind his name. So he starts off from a place that he's got to do a lot of catch up, and it's a long haul for a Democrat to be able to do that. The last Democrat that won a statewide election was Jan Graham
in this seat,
and so that's a long time that we've seen that.
Robert Gerke, is it simply just D versus R here, and that's people can't get past that?
Yeah, I mean, well, to some degree, I think it is. But I also think that, you know, we started talking, started the show discussing COVID. I think COVID has disrupted the way these campaigns have been run, without question. And I think it plays to the advantage of the incumbent, because if you can't outwork your opponent, you know, and you can't outrage your opponent, because incumbency, you know, incumbents always raise more than their challengers in 99.9% of the cases, right? And so I think that it plays the advantage of incumbency. You can get on the airwaves. And so I think for a challenger like Skordas, like Cale Weston, and maybe to some degree like Burgess Owens, although Burgess Owens raised $2.5 million in the last quarter, it really has made it difficult to knock off one of these incumbents. Even more so, obviously, if there's a decided Republican advantage statewide and in the respective congressional districts. So, yeah, I'm not expecting to see very many surprises on election night.
All right, Robert Gerke there. We are going to Dan Harry also. Thanks for catching us up on this debate. And Bethany Rogers, thanks to you. We'll take a quick break. This is Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. We will be right back.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu. Support also comes from Utah State University, declaring 2020 the Year of the Woman, celebrating often unknown Aggie women, those who served as pioneers from the institution's earliest days to those paving the way for future generations of leaders and innovators. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on Utah Public Radio. If you tune in for this program every week, consider making a donation of your support to UPR so we can continue to bring you the news you rely on us for. Donate now at upr.org, and thank you.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I think I want to get to just one more story before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And this is a story that is simply about something that a state senator said in a legislative meeting this week. And Bethany Rogers, you covered that story. I actually have audio of the quote here itself, so maybe I could just have you set up the audio. This committee that we are having this debate, it has to do with police dogs. What is the committee, and why are they having this debate?
Yeah, so this is the legislature's committee on law enforcement and criminal justice, and there has been a lot of discussion in Utah in the past couple months about the use of police canines and how they're used especially to apprehend suspects. The Salt Lake Tribune several months ago published footage of a Salt Lake City police officer using a dog to bite a man who was complying on his knees with his hands up. The man has had to have surgeries on his leg and had nerve damage as a result, and the officer has since been charged with a felony. Salt Lake City is currently going, has conducted an audit of incidents in which they've used police canines and the dogs have bit people. And after that found, concluded that there was a pattern of abuse of power in the use of those canines. So the Salt Lake City Police Department has still suspended at its use of its canine program at this point. And so this issue made its way to the state legislature, and lawmakers this week discussed whether they needed to pass something into law, basically codifying what best practices are for using police dogs. And it was in the course of that discussion that this this quote happened.
Okay, and so talking about implementing best practices when it comes to, again, the use of police dogs, and in the context of that audit from Salt Lake City, here's the exchange between Senator Don Ipson and also the committee chair, Representative Lee Perry, I believe. So I'll just play the clip, and then we can talk about it afterwards. Here's the quote.
Senator Ipson.
Yeah, just don't make it restrictive. Let them keep doing their job.
We
don't want to be restrictive to that. We want to be sure that they're not premature in their biting or their, but I don't have a lot of sympathy, so.
Okay. So we just want to make sure, like I said, that we have something in place that benefits the ability for law enforcement to say we're trained, we're ready to go.
And we don't want to harm the public.
Yeah.
But if they don't want to get bit, stay home.
Okay, so if you don't want to get bit, stay home. It's good advice for coronavirus, I think. But did Senator Ipson clarify that position further, Bethany, during this committee meeting?
Yeah, he said that he misspoke and he apologized for suggesting that people need to stay in their houses in order to not get attacked by police dogs. But what he said his point was is that, you know, people shouldn't commit crimes if they don't want to have negative encounters with police.
Okay, but that's solid advice, but the apprehension of suspects doesn't necessarily mean the apprehension of guilty parties, and sometimes dogs are used in getting people who may in the end be innocent. We have so little time on this, and you pointed out the audit from Salt Lake City. Isn't the city also facing a lawsuit over the use of that specific police dog with the body camera footage?
Yeah, the man who was bit, he's suing the Salt Lake City Police Department over the injuries that he suffered.
Just before I turn to Gerke, did this committee at the state level, did it take any action when it comes to, having a kind of best practices on police use of canines?
They did. They voted unanimously to explore a bill on this. There were very few specifics about what that bill would look like, although they did talk about the fact that, you know, they believe that Salt Lake, our Utah officers have access to really good training and have already developed you know, their training academy has already developed really solid best practices and standards for using police canines. So they said maybe they could just codify that.
Robert Gerke, a quick comment, for, you know, your take on Senator Ipsen's comment and also on, the idea, I guess, of don't commit crimes if you don't want to get bit by dogs.
Well, I mean, that's kind of absurd, right? I mean, but there's going to Bethany's last point, if there's adequate training in place, we wouldn't see this problem that the mayor and the police chief identified with the dogs being misused and you know, unjustly being put on suspects who in some cases are compliant. This, the lawsuit that Jessica Miller wrote about, it was the only way that the police department even knew about it, so there's a problem there too. I think it deserves a careful review. I don't think we're going to get it from the legislature because, as we've seen with these comments from Senator Ipsen, they don't think it's a problem and they don't care if people are being attacked by dogs. It's pretty callous, I think, on part of the legislature Senator Ipsen.
But Bethany says they are going to investigate something, and they've agreed to consider that.
I mean, they're not going to have a meaningful response to this. We've seen this too often with the legislature that they end up caving at the end of the day.
All right. Well, with that, Robert Gerke's opinions there from the news desk, columnist's desk, we are out of time and have to turn to our final segment of the show, the Underplayed Stories of the Week. And Dan Harry, news and politics editor, what have you got for a pick for Underplayed Story?
I'm going to turn to a story in today's Tribune by Andy Larson, a columnist who does a lot of data crunching, and he's looking at the spoiled ballots in this election. We've had 310 ballots processed so far in the election, and 7,653 have been spoiled. In other words, they won't be counted. And so, he details why those ballots are being thrown out.
Huh. Wow. Check that out at sltrib.com. I had not seen that, and I will go there after the show. Robert Gerke, what's your pick for Underplayed Story?
I mean, I think this has obviously gotten a lot of attention, but on the two-year anniversary of the murder of Lauren McCluskey, the university admitted that it had made a mistake. President Watkins had apologized to the family. They agreed to pay the family $13.5 million that will go into a nonprofit campus safety initiative that the family started. Yeah. But this comes, again, 2 years after her death, after years of denying that they could have done anything differently, after threats of litigation, some final closure on this sad episode.
And 2 years to the date, as a matter of fact. Bethany Rogers, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Yeah, there are a couple stories in the paper this week that offered really good information on the amendments that voters are seeing on their ballots right now. There was a roundup that we had, and then there was also a story specifically on Amendment D, which is on municipal water service, and something that I think you probably wouldn't be able to understand unless you did a little bit of research.
Thanks very much, Bethany. Great picks at sltrib.com. You can find those. Bethany Rogers, Robert Gerke, and Dan Harry from the Tribune, thanks for joining me today.
Have a great weekend.
Sure.
You too. That does it for Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Join us again next week. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org.
Support for Utah Public Radio programming comes from our members and Salt Lake City Weekly, a Utah news source since 1984, covering music, dining, nightlife, and more in Salt Lake City and beyond. Available weekly at 1,800 locations across the Wasatch Front or online at cityweekly.net.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.